from inside the fourth floor of Titan Towers. This is the Writer's Room. Now, your host, former WWE head writer, TV film producer, and writer, Alex Greenfield.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Writer's Room. I'm Alex Greenfield. I suspect we're going to have a few new listeners to the show given our guest this week, so figured I'd take this opportunity to tell you all a little bit about myself and the podcast here on the MLW Radio Network. I worked for WWE in the mid-2000s. I was head writer of SmackDown and worked on a bunch of stories that have grown legendary through the years for their relative lack of competence. And I've since done a bunch of TV movies for NBC and Spike TV and even the Hallmark Channel and Lifetime. I've even done a few cool movies that are actual films, like The Sand, a terrifying masterpiece that you can find on Amazon. Anyway, about a year ago, I stumbled on doing this podcast, and it's become a fun weekly thing for our VIP subscribers. We go sort of deep inside the WWE creative department in a way that most podcasts don't do. We lean on into the real depths of the creative process, and we tell a bunch of pretty outrageous stories and anecdotes from my time at WWE, along with my guests, which range from WWE writers to wrestlers to all kinds of other folks who've been involved in the creative aspects of WWE and creative in wrestling generally, from promotions really all over the world. So usually this show is an MLW VIP show, but this week we thought we'd give you a sample of what we do here on the Writer's Room. So this is part one of a two-parter. The second part will drop tomorrow exclusively for MLW VIP subscribers. So if you want to hear it, go VIP for just $2 a month, $1.99 really, and you'll get exclusive premium shows from a who's who here at MLW Radio, including MVP, Court Bauer, all kinds of folks. To sign up, go to mlwradio.com, click on the red button in the top right corner, and plug in your credit card, or now you can use PayPal. You'll have access to part two of this show, as well as like over 1,000 podcasts in our archives going all the way back to 2011. Plugs are out of the way now. You can set in and settle in your attention, because it's time to get down to it with Big Dave Bautista. He's just wrapped last week Guardians of the Galaxy 2. He just had a great turn as Hinks, like this awesome old school villain in James Bond. And dude, he is about to star in the sequel to one of the greatest science fiction movies of all time in Blade Runner. So sit back, grab yourself a delicious adult beverage, and listen to Dave Bautista and me chop it up about all things wrestling and movies and our shared love for porn actress Remy LaCroix. So the first question I have is a pretty obvious one, and that is, like, when you're driving around and you pull up to a red light and you sort of glance up in the rearview mirror and catch your own eyes, or when you're walking down the street and you catch your reflection in a plate glass mirror, do you ever just stop and think to yourself, holy shit, I wasn't just, you know, the WWE World Heavyweight Champion, I'm a Bond villain, I am a comic book hero, and I'm about to be in a sequel to one of the greatest science fiction films of all time. Like, how surreal is your life right now, and does that ever catch you back and make you say, wow, how the fuck did I get here?
What's funny is I can honestly say that I've never, ever looked at my reflection and thought that. And I still, you know, it's weird, man. I don't know. You know, sometimes it hits me and I'm like, it's amazing. But, you know, I mean, you know me, man. I live such a simple life that I don't know, man. I don't think of it in those terms. I think it's just because also I'm not really thinking about where I'm at right now. I'm like very impatient about where I want to get, and this isn't even close to where I want to get. So I just don't, right now I'm not reflecting because I'm still moving forward. I think when I stop moving forward, you know, is when I will sit back and reflect, and hopefully that's when I'm much older and chilling on a beach somewhere with my wife and my dogs. But I'm not there yet, man. I'm not there, not even close.
Nor should you be. I mean, look at the body of work that you've created in just the last few years between, I told you, oh, we're not going to go linearly through your career, but I mean, let's look back at like when you did Brass Body for RZA it was sort of, I feel like, a revelation to a lot of people because you got so many different elements across. How did you, because I know you'd been out there for a couple of years, how did you end up with that gig as sort of your big start, you know, ignoring like Smallville and the other gigs that you'd done before that, but how did that end up being your start? How did you hook up with RZA, who I just think is magnificent on so many levels. Like Ghost Dog is literally my favorite soundtrack of all time.
That's so funny, man, because I've always wanted, one of my dreams is actually to do and star in a sequel to Ghost Dog. And I've got this whole storyline.
My God, that'd be great.
I don't know if it'll ever happen, but I just love that movie to death, man. And RZA, of course, I'm not only a fan of, but I'm really proud to call that guy a friend. Like, I really love this guy, man. He's such a good dude, and he's just, he's so artistic, and I can't say enough good things about RZA. But it was weird how that all happened, man, because when I left the WWE, I didn't have any offers to do movies. And then when I got out, the stuff that I was being offered was really, really horrible stuff. It was horrible, straight to DVD. Cheesy stuff, and it's not what I wanted to do. I really
what I spend most of my career writing.
Don't know, man. Don't sell yourself short. But I just didn't want to be, I didn't want to be a cliche, man. I really wanted to be an actor, and it took some doing to actually convincing people that I really wanted to do some acting. But the way I hooked up with RZA was really a roundabout way, and it wasn't the way I didn't plan on this happening, but he was familiar with me from wrestling, but he didn't know I was a martial artist. And a friend of his showed him a video of me and a guy named Maurice Crump, who was a very close friend and the guy who I was training with at the time, showed him a video of us doing Kali. And he needed somebody big and imposing to play this part of Brass Body. So he actually just, he asked me, he gave me a shout and asked me if I was interested. And I said, yeah, definitely. And so I flew out to L.A. to meet him, and we talked about him. It was so funny because when I first met him, he was they were doing a video. Method Man was doing a video. So we went there, and we talked a bit, and then we hung out a bit, and then we smoked a bit.
This is the kind of audition process that I look for in all of my talent.
A little bit different, but it was something, funny enough, it was just something I was real comfortable with because – I'm inner city kid, man. I'm an urban kid. I grew up in D.C. and I wasn't uncomfortable with this at all, man. I actually loved this environment. We were just hanging around with Wu-Tang, chilling. So anyway, that's how it came. And so then I got that part, and I was like, wow, I was all of a sudden like thrust into this movie that I was going to be in with guys who were established stars. And so I was like, I better get some experience fast. And so and then we reached out and took a couple roles that I wasn't crazy about, but I took them because I wanted to get some experience and I wanted to work with some good actors. So I took the parts, and we went on the Iron Fist, and then I literally struggled for years to come up with the roles. It really wasn't until I landed Guardians that doors started to open. I didn't even have an agent. I had an agent. I got an agent like the week before I went in. He actually sent me in for the audition for Guardians. I couldn't even get anybody to represent me.
No, I mean, look, that's a thing that I'm very, very familiar with. Like, I over the years, like, it takes finding the right chemistry at exactly the right time, too. Because I'll tell you, man, like, I wrote this spec in 2000. It was very much a response to 9/11. So early 2002. And it got a reasonable amount of heat. I'd been working in the business in a manager's office as a frickin' assistant for a while. And I got an agent off this spec, and they took the spec out. And it was like a one-and-done thing. Like, the spec didn't sell, and the guy totally forgot about me. And I had a terrible manager and a terrible agent and then another terrible manager. Like, I went through this process for years, like, to the point that I was booking my own gigs. But they were taking the commissions for him, for sure. And it took really like Ben and I, my writing partner and I, ended up hooking up with Andrew Wilson at Zero Gravity last November. And finding the right person at the right time makes all the fucking difference. I mean, we talked a little bit off air about this, just DMing back and forth the other day. But we're like this is, as we record this on Sunday, the 19th of June, it's one of those, I'm sure you've been through this, one of those terrible freaking weekends where the deal points have been come to. And now it's the wait through the weekend. So you're just like, oh, my God, just get me the official offer. I'm dying all weekend long.
Oh, man. It's so funny, yeah, because I'm at that with a few things now. We're waiting. It's the Hollywood waiting game, man. It's stressful, right?
It's so stressful. I mean, there's a cliche you talk about all the time that I know you've heard a million times, but it's hurry up and wait.
Right,
and that
right.
They all the producers and all the studios want everything that they want right now. And as soon as you give it to them, holy shit, you've got to wait forever. It's the most brutal thing.
It's the worst if you're waiting for something, you know, that's coming up during the holidays, like Thanksgiving through New Year's. You're just on hold, man.
I swear to God, I don't know how many times I've gotten like to the point in the negotiation where you're waiting on the paper, right? Where you're waiting on the contract to come through, and it's Memorial Day weekend or Labor Day weekend or fucking whatever, and it ends up what people who don't work in the business don't realize is. Really, I mean, you can tell me if the experience is different at the higher level that you're working at, but really, business only gets done on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays on any freaking week. And on a holiday week, that means you're down to, like, if you don't get a call on Wednesday or Thursday, you are 100% fucked.
Yeah, no. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's brutal. And that's why it's really hard for people when, you know, people want me to schedule things like, you know, what are you doing 2 months from now? I was like, man, just ask me the day before. You know, I can't plan that far ahead because I, you know, stuff's like always in the works. Something's always up in the air. You're always waiting for an answer. It's just like it's impossible to, like, you know, make long-term plans.
No, I mean, it really is. Like, I mean, and look, this is something that WWE prepared the both of us well, right? Like, I don't know how many times we had sort of a long-term story planned or, you know, something leading into a program or a marriage or whatever. And then, you know, you're sitting in the freaking agents meeting and Vince completely changes his mind, like, on the day on some what he thinks is a little thing, like a finish on a TV match or whatever the thing is that completely blows all of the plans that you've had brewing for months and months down the road. Oh, my God, it drove me crazy.
That was one of the things I always, you know, and I always gave WWE credit for is, It was such a grind, man, and it was so, you know, everything was so spur of the moment. Everything was constantly changing. You constantly had to be just flexible and willing to go with the flow and willing to, you know, put in that grind and not complain. Because if you did complain, you weren't employed for long.
No, but I
carry that with me, and people are, you know, I love that people are, like, super impressed with that. But it's like, I don't know how to be any other way. This is the way I've, you know, been trained to be for the last 15 years. So I don't know any. I don't know how to be that like high maintenance person who's always bitching and complaining and not willing to put in the hours and put in the grind. It just, this is the way I've been programmed to be. This is why I did last in the WWE. So they did. They did prepare me for this type of grind. You know, it's easy compared to the WWE.
I mean, it was like boot camp. You know, it's interesting. That does bring up something interesting to me, though. In a personal context, I found that, you know, that the 18 months I was at WWE prepared me for anything. Like, I've done everything from, you know, like while working in MMA, you know, producing for Strikeforce to doing features to doing all of these things. But I also found, like, especially shortly after I left, like, I booked a feature before I left the company in 2006. And I don't think I would have, like as much as I have been known online to complain about WWE, I don't think I would have left if I didn't have the other gig waiting for me when I did. But it's... when I started doing the rounds of meetings after that, boy, like, people still don't get the level of complexity. And I wonder from you whether the same is true as a performer. It's not that there's a stink on wrestling exactly, but they certainly look at you in a very specific way and for very specific genres when you walk out of the business. And I wonder if you found that true as well.
Oh, for sure. It's weird. They don't get a lot of things about it. They don't really, a lot of people still look at it as that very lowbrow form of entertainment. They don't realize how much goes into the production, how much actually goes, you know, they see they're, you know, they're not fans and they think it's just two big sweaty guys beating each other up in a ring and it's fake fighting. You know, they don't get it at all. They don't understand that there's a storyline to it. And they also don't understand how big it is around the world. It's a global thing. You know, it's not just a local, it's not a United States thing. It's not even just a North American thing. It's a global thing. So they just don't really realize how huge it is and how huge of a production it is and how much, you know, goes into it and how really great, like, some of the entertainers are. And, you know, I say all professional wrestlers are definitely not created equal, but some of them are very, very skillful and talented, which is, you know, and those guys have been able to, you know, transition into any form of entertainment they want to pursue. So I think that's it. Some people most people just don't get it. They don't understand. If, you know, they're not fans, they don't get it. But I've been lucky enough to come across those few people that do get it, you know, and gave me an opportunity. Then, and carrying on that, some people who, once I established myself in Hollywood, some people who, you know, really saw that, well, he's not only got this fan base, but he's got this fan base as well. So it's definitely, now it's become like this huge bonus for me. No, so it's been great. It's actually it was hard at first, but, you know, I really look at it as an asset, and it's something I carry with me. And I always feel like, you know, I really love that I could go back to wrestling, you know, whenever I wanted, you know, whether, you know, they accepted me or not, or really welcomed me with open arms. I still have that opportunity where I could go back. Like, I feel that feels really great to have.
It's an interesting thing. Like, I remember when you came back on, was it 2014, right before the Royal Rumble, or 2015? Yeah, 2014, right before the Royal Rumble. Just the level of love that the fan base has for you. And separate and apart from, like, I know you've talked about it, and I certainly have, whether the storyline was right or not, just the level of love that the fans had when you first came out. And that must have been just the biggest thrill in the world when you came out. And to a person, everyone in that arena, and clearly millions of people in TV land, were just so delighted to see you again. I mean, I know, just as a pure fan, I had no advance notice that you were coming back. That was a really fun moment. It must have felt like the biggest kick in the world.
It really didn't.
Oh, were you already dealing with the story stuff when you walked out? Oh, geez.
Right from before I went back, I was arguing with them. You know, for one, you know, Vince wanted me to come back as a babyface, and I was like, it's not going to work, man. I'm a heel. They want me to be a heel. They like me. They like me as a heel. I'm a good heel. And he was like, no, they miss you. They love you. And I was like, you know, that's going to last for 2 seconds. And then also the first night I went back, they wanted me to come out and do this goofy thing with, you know, all these other people in the ring. And I was like, my first night back, give me 5 minutes alone, just me and the fans. Let me, you know, let me just have the ring to myself for a night, you know, for my first night back. And they didn't want to do that. So it was a real struggle from the very beginning. And then Vince just wanted to push me, you know, shove me down their throats as a babyface. And it just got, you know, it got worse and worse. And the more they shoved me down people's throats, the more they resented me for being there. And then there was, you know, all the stuff with Punk leaving, and somehow I was blamed for that. It was just really odd. It just wasn't good from the very beginning. And also, you know, there's a few other things that, you know, just personally, I wish I could have changed about coming back. Like, I wish I could have been in better shape. I should have been in wrestling shape, and I really wasn't, for a few different reasons. One, I was injured coming back. I had a really bad Achilles tendon injury. But also, I had stayed away from the weights and really strenuous working out for years because I was trying to conform and be, you know, I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to look like an actor. I wanted to blend in and fit in. So I was really against, like, I was trying to get away from that muscle-bound look. And, you know, the fans, they always kind of respected me for that look. That was something I carried with me and set me apart. And I didn't give them that. And I really wish I had. I really, really wish. Now when I look back on pictures, I really am embarrassed about the shape that I was in. I should have been in better shape for that. But so that's just kind of a personal thing. But it was really a struggle, like, right from the very beginning.
You know, it's interesting. Like I was as sort of watching as a fan through all of that. Like, I felt like there was this great moment. I wish I could remember. I should have pulled it up on YouTube because everything's up there. But there was this great moment where you cut a promo. I think it was a backstage thing. It was probably a pre-tape where you basically said, and I'm paraphrasing badly, but you basically said, look at me, I'm a comic book hero, and you're here supporting this Daniel Bryan guy. And I was just like, oh, my God, like, that's the Dave we need. And I have argued back and forth for a long time. I feel like that was the moment at which they let you have your own voice as opposed to people like me coming in and trying to write for you. Was that the case? Like when they allowed you to break into your villain persona, was that the moment you found your comfort?
Absolutely. And that's what I mean. I was just beating my head against the wall, struggling, fighting with them, arguing. Every day I was gone to, you know, I was standing outside of Vince's office waiting to talk to him. It was, you know, that
Jesus,
feel.
You must have felt like a flashback coming off Guardians, because you'd wrapped Guardians at that point, but not.
I wrapped Guardians, you know, even, you know, when I was just starting to really break into my stride when I had to leave, and I had to leave. I stayed a month longer than I was supposed to because I just, you know, I felt like so. I felt so unsatisfied with that return. It just broke my heart because I'd been thinking about years for going back. I missed it and I wanted to be there. So I was just starting to hit my stride and I literally had to leave because I had to go and start promoting Guardians. But when I left, and I haven't talked to a lot of people about this, and I don't care if they're pissed for me saying something, but I wanted to come back and do SummerSlam because I was going to have an opportunity. Survivor Series. And I would have had the opportunity to go back. And I talked to Stephen Hunter about it. And I think that was, I apologize. It was SummerSlam because it was August. I wanted to come back around the release of the film around Guardians. And I said, wouldn't it be great if I was back? And the number, you know, I was also in the number one movie in the world. And they kind of had a snicker. And it was, you know, we don't even know if the movie's going to be good. And it was one of those moments. And I was like, okay.
I love the half-assed Hunter impression. Well, we don't even know if it's going to be good yet.
No, literally, and I swear, I'm not exaggerating. It was that, and it was a very uncomfortable moment where I think they were just kind of doubting me and laughing in my face. And it's like, okay, but it's not that I wanted to leave. I wanted to come back. They're really difficult to work with, man, and they're just not very, very flexible. If I ever went back, it would be a lot different. A lot of different reasons. I would make sure, before I even went back, that I knew what I was getting into, and they had a plan, and they stuck to it, and I held them accountable for what they promised me. Last time I really didn't, and it was just really sorry about the way the whole thing went, man. Just still, I'm a little sour about it still.
I can hear the sourness in your voice, but I also I feel like the fanboy blowing smoke up your ass. I think that what you ended up finding in the end, like I keep remembering. Like the little villainous things you did, like wearing the blue arm warmers, and people started the blue Tista chant, and the way you utilized social media to get over the character of the version of yourself that you were portraying, I thought was brilliant. I liked a lot of that stuff, and I think that both the triple threat and the match with the Shield was really well done. I don't think you should be down on yourself about that run. The beginning wasn't your fault, and once they got in line with, and I mean, it's not. It's believe me, I'm the last person in the world to defend fucking WWE, but I feel like you did a lot of great work on that run, and people still talk about it. I'll give one example. Remember there was like this big among the internet wrestling community, there was this big, Dave doesn't want to put over Daniel Bryan or whatever. Like to the point that I even as a fucking mark, like
I never respond to silly little things like that. But I was like, guys, did you see fucking Dave's work with Ray? Did you see, like, people were saying that after you put him over at Mania.
Oh, that's what's killing me. They were like, they wanted, you know, I did the thing with Daniel Bryan. And let me tell you the reason why I was pissed about that whole thing. And the reason why, because I didn't want to work with them at the next pay-per-view. I wanted to work with S.H.I.E.L.D. I wanted to do that Evolution thing. So it wasn't anything against Daniel Bryan, and it wasn't because I loved Evolution so much. I wanted to do the Evolution thing, and that's what kills me. So the first thing, the whole Daniel Bryan thing. Yeah, I love Daniel. Everybody gave me a lot of grief over that, and I was one of the first guys way back when was saying Daniel's great. We've got to do something with him. They wanted me to job him out. The only time we ever worked together, I was like, he's just way too good for that. And like when people they gave me like all this shit about being so anti-Daniel Bryan, and I just didn't know where it came from. But the reason here's what I hated about the whole Daniel Bryan thing. And so we did the thing at Mania, which was great, man. I wanted to get him over. I agreed to tap out to him. It was no big deal. I never made a big deal out of it. The thing that I made a big deal out of was that we did the deal that night. The next night, after he had gotten off a stretcher, gone through hell the whole night, they wanted, and it wasn't his call, but they wanted him to come back not selling anything. Like not selling that he was sore or beat up or injured. Nothing. And so even at the end of the night, again, they have him, we like give him all of our finishes, we beat him all up. And then right after that, he's just up, you know, chanting, yes, yes, after he had taken like three finishes for him, just like buried the shit out of us. So I was like, I'm all for him getting him over and putting him over. But don't bury us while we're doing it. You don't have, it doesn't have to be that way. We're not only burying us, but burying the whole business. Like, that's what pissed me off. And so, and then the whole thing with the Shield, like, I love that whole run, man. I loved working with those guys. The thing is that we put them over like $1 million, then they split them right up.
Literally the next night after what was one of the matches of the year. What the fuck?
They could have them running for at least a year together, man. Those guys were great. The Shield was such a strong unit, man. They could have milked that for everything it was worth, man. They should have had them running with the Wyatts till they were just, everybody was sick of seeing it. But they split them right up. But not only that, but we did this match where we all beat the shit out of each other. And of course, you know, I don't mind being the fall guy. I'll take the fall, whatever. They can go over me. I'll put them over like $1 million. But the thing that pissed me off is we busted our ass to get those fucking guys over, and everybody walked away was saying, Batista wore blue. What an asshole. Fucking, really? That's what you got out of that fucking match? That I wore blue? That shit pissed me off, man. it just pissed me off.
Dude, like, here's the sad thing. I'm still, after, you know, fucking, I don't even know, but the better part of 40 years at this point, I'm still such a wrestling fan that all I'm like is, like, I want that Angry Dave to come back. Like, that's the guy I fucking want to come back, just freaking killing everyone until whoever the hero is can finally stop you.
That's the thing, and I love being a heel. I'm confident as a heel. I feel comfortable as a heel. People like to see me as a heel. But I can't be a heel if they're constantly beating me. I've got to be a strong heel. So when I put somebody over, it actually means something. I don't think a lot of people missed that point. I don't know how they missed it. But you know what really bothered me about the whole that run as well is while people were so busy chanting, you know, CM Punk or You Suck or Bautista or Bautista, they actually missed a lot of really good wrestling. Like Dolph and I had some kick-ass matches that we threw together at the last second. And everybody missed it, man, because they were so busy, you know, they're so busy wrapped up in their CM Punk chants or their just Bautista chants. They missed out on a lot of good wrestling, man, and a lot of good, you know, just good old-fashioned storytelling. And it really hurt my feelings that people just... They missed out on that, and it was just a shame.
Do you think, I feel like I have three different questions to ask. I guess the first one will be, do you think they were missing it? Or this is something I've talked to a couple of folks on the show about, being you know, I grew up in Atlanta. I grew up as a fan of guys like Flair and the Horsemen and people like that. Like, I was and in WWF, I was a fan of Piper much more than Hogan. Like, I've always been a heel fan, sort of, even before I was anything other than a mark, before I knew the first, you know, gimmick, before I knew the first insider term. Do you feel like, because I only say this because, like, on my Twitter, on which is very sort of inclined toward wrestling, or Cage Side Seats, which is my favorite of the wrestling blogs, people have very good, albeit in the limited set of sort of smarky marks, people have a very good feeling about you and a very good impression of you. And, like, it's like, as soon as, you know, WWE is doing a brand split again, which we had our own problems with back in the day, but they're doing a brand split again, and, like, among the first things people talked about is, oh, well, you know, if I were Vince, I'd pull the fucking Brink strap up in front of Batista's house to get the new brand over. But people had a really good impression of you, I think, even after that run. So I guess my question is, do you think that they were really saying Bautista or whatever? Or do you think that it was, you know, in the same way that I'll publicly boo a guy like Kevin Owens, despite the fact that I really love his craftsmanship, because as a villain, I feel like I shouldn't be out there cheering for a guy who's trying to get booze. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I don't. That wasn't the impression that I got. I think that it was more the impression that they were just so anti-me. It's like someone implanted, you know, that it was almost like the trendy thing to be anti-me. So, yeah, it wasn't like they were booing me because I was, you know, being their, you know, the heel or whatever, or they weren't, you know, booing it because it was a show. It was like a personal attack. It really wasn't something that was, you know, show related or entertainment based. It was really like a personal attack. It became that everything I did, you know, and it was like an internet thing. Everything that I did that I was, you know, I came back and I demanded to come back and win the Rumble and main event, you know, WrestleMania. And this was like, none of this shit was my idea. You know, I just wanted to come back. I didn't ask for a lot of money. I didn't say, I'm not going to do house shows. I didn't say, I won't put this guy. I never said any of that. I just wanted to come back and wrestle. You know, so it really wasn't so much. You know, it's weird because somebody said to me when I first left, because I was really confused by the way the crowd was acting. They had changed a lot since I left. And somebody said to me, and it stuck in my head, it said, it's you know, it's monkey see, monkey do. You know, if somebody starts doing something, the rest of the people will start doing it. And it was also, it was like the crowd, they don't really want to watch the show, and they don't want to really participate in the show. They want to be the show. And that really seemed true sometimes. It's like they didn't even care what was going on in the ring. They just wanted to you know, they wanted to be the show. They wanted to be the highlight of the show. And I always say, if you want to be the highlight of the show, go to fucking wrestling school. Lace up your goddamn boots. Take your bumps like everybody else. And then, you know, you go through the steps, man. Go, you know, start off with the wrestling camp. But don't come and not, you know, watch the show and, you know, give the performers the respect that they deserve. They're out there, you know, beating themselves half to hell for you to entertain you. And you can't even give them the respect of, you know, just watching the show. We're all for interaction. But don't try to steal the show by chanting stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with what's going on in the ring. Like, come, pay attention, man. Be a fan. That's your job. You be a fan, I'll be a wrestler. You know, if you want to be a wrestler, go to wrestling school. Start there.
Does that
make sense? Sorry, I was rambling a little bit.
No. I totally get it. But do you... it's an interesting question, I think, because firstly, like, your social media game, just on Twitter and the other sort of public-facing social media accounts you have is very strong. I wonder if you think... speaking purely as a wrestler and a performer in the ring, like separating out your acting career from it, do you think that social media is a plus or a minus to being a performer in wrestling as a whole? Because you have these, it's not just a one way form of communication, like the Aptermags when we were kids, right? Like it's fucking. you hear the trolls, and I certainly, you know, you look at the reviews of my fucking movies, buddy. You hear the trolls a lot clearer, the haters, I guess, right, a lot right. clearer than you sometimes hear the people who appreciate the work.
Yeah.
Like, is it good or bad on the whole? Because the flip side is the level of interaction between between superstars, trademark copyright, and the public is also a lot more direct. And I would guess that you get sort of both sides of it. But how do you feel about social media in the business?
It's a love hate thing. I'm pretty sure, like everybody else does, in every business, it's a love hate thing. It's because I love it because I love that everybody has a voice. Unfortunately, some of those people you give a voice to are going to be cowards who hide behind their keyboards, and they say things because they know they won't be held accountable for them. And some of them are just vicious attacks. It's their way of lashing out, no matter where that hatred comes from. It's a form of hatred, you know. And so I don't dig that, but you learn to weed that out and use the block button a lot.
I'm at a much lower level of fame, so I use the mute button because I don't want them to know that I blocked them, that they've even gotten through that much.
Right, and when I see that some people, they give opinions that are just completely uneducated, and they're just kind of based on emotion and stuff, and, well, that's all good. I mean, I really got to learn to weed it out, but it's a love-hate relationship. I think, you know, everybody will have that same kind of generic answer. It's, you know, it's always going to be a love-hate thing because the great thing about the internet is it gives everybody a voice, and the worst, you know, the horrible thing about the internet is it gives everybody a voice. You know,
no shit.
So,
in fairness, says the guy doing a podcast with you right now. So I can't really throw stones in the glass house.
right. But you know, it's all good. You just kind of got to learn how to be a little thick-skinned when it comes to this stuff. But I like, you know, my Twitter is my Twitter, and I don't. One, I don't whore it out. Two, I only follow a certain number of people because I really feel like that's the only, I mean, that's like 100 people is a lot of people to follow. But I feel like I can give attention to those 100 people and follow them thoroughly where I know what's going on in their lives. I feel like when you get in to see people that are following thousands of people, like, how can you keep up with all those people? Like, I really like to, like, I take my Twitter personally. Yeah. You know, I really like to be interactive with people. So that's my Facebook. Like, Facebook confuses me. My manager, Jonathan, usually handles my Facebook just because I don't understand Facebook. But, you know, Twitter is so kind of one-on-one, very, very personal. So I run my Twitter, and I try not to follow. I try to follow as many people as I really believe I can keep up with.
That's such an interesting thing because I'm totally the opposite. My Twitter is... Like, when I first got on Facebook, I sort of friended anyone who sent me a friend request, and I ended up sort of scaling that back and scaling that back and scaling that back over the years, because a lot of times, and it's not a piss on fans at all, but people, I ended up coming to, I have to at least have interacted with you in a one-on-one way to be on my Facebook, but my Twitter is much more... that's where I follow people like, Stephen Colbert we were talking about the various porn requests you get on Skype, before the thing, but that's where I'll follow Remy LaCroix or things like that. Like, that's where I follow the people who I don't know and who certainly who I interact with a bunch of people who, you know, I'm never going to meet in my life. But Facebook's just the opposite thing. That's the friends and family thing for me. And I guess maybe it's just what social media you've come to first.
I'm also a Remy fan.
I am a big Remy fan. Remy LaCroix, you are much, much loved by many folks from the wrestling biz, apparently.
I appreciate you. My wife's so cool about all that stuff. Because I've actually tweeted a couple times. Like, I'm on the road a lot. You know, I'm away from my wife a lot. I mean, usually, you know, my laptop is
my laptop. Don't check my history.
But yeah, Remy's definitely one of my go-tos.
Yeah, no kidding. Remy is the best. And here's the thing. I mean, talking about social media presences, she is smart and funny and interesting to read. Like she is one of the people I follow on Twitter. My Twitter follower, the number of people I'll follow is very specific though. I always have 217 people or entities or whatever. I have 217 things that I'm following. And the reason I picked 217, here's what a fucking nerd I am, dude. So you remember the documentary about the Stanley Kubrick film, The Shining, Room 237 from a few years ago?
I do.
In the novel, it turns out they changed the room number from the novel to the film because the hotel where they were shooting that was doubling for the Overlook was it actually had a room 217, and they didn't want like people to be freaked out about the room, so they changed it to room 237. The real number, as a constant reader of Stephen King, is 217. So I have 217 followers, and in the like, where are you from thing on Twitter, I'm from room 217, and yeah. Being a horror movie writer is the only career choice I could have had. It was either that or, I don't know, pulling a lever somewhere.
Oh, that's great, man. That's fine. I didn't know that, man. That's pretty cool. That whole documentary was really kind of way over my head, too. It was like so many subliminal messages and just read into everything, man. It's kind of crazy. But I guess
that though leads me to one of the things, you know, when we were first talking that I want to get to. So you were mentioning how much after the WrestleMania, whatever number it was, but after the WrestleMania where you and Randy and Brian had your match, you wanted to go right back to the Evolution thing. And I wanted to flip back in time a little bit to There was, I remember very specifically this moment where I realized, you know, having come out of, you know, a minimal experience, but some experience producing in Hollywood, to realizing, oh shit, Dave Bautista is one of these fucking guys who's going to go far beyond the business. We did this pre-tape with you and Randy backstage. I think it was after you'd hurt your tricep or your lap, or your lat. You had two injuries sort of right on top of each other right after I'd started in late 2005.
Right.
And
right.
You and Randy were doing this pre-tape backstage. And, I didn't really have a sense of the history. Like just that period, the Evolution period, I hadn't been a fan.
Right.
Not because really more of a, not a fan in the sense of, I just wasn't watching the shows at that point. You know, you sort of add in and out of wrestling.
Right.
And, you and Randy did this exchange, and I can't even remember what the verbiage was. And we'd already gotten to that point, to the point that like my verbiage for you was like a series of bullet points that you would then turn into your own language. Right. But you and Randy was always, for me anyway, one of those guys who wanted dialogue as opposed to improvisational sketches.
Right.
And your chemistry with him, you basically, I mean, the long and short of it is to put myself over, right? The long and short of it is you ended up taking direction of the scene. And it worked, like, you guys did one take and out, and it was perfect. And I was like, I don't know, let me get Stephanie. And Stephanie thought it was perfect, and, like, everybody knew that it was perfect. And that was the moment that I realized, sort of, that you were, I don't mean this as a piss on the other guys, but you were sort of operating at a different level. And I just wonder when in your WWE experience, or maybe even before the WWE experience, did you realize that you had a sense of, like, you had a sense that a lot of guys didn't on camera placement and on where to stand in the light? Like, you just had an innate instinct for this, even before, I believe, you were training as an actor. When did that become an interest for you? Like, were you a cinema buff? Like, how did you start to fall into what would become your primary career as an actor?
let me. This is going to be a long answer, so let me take it in pieces. But
yeah, first, well, my questions are fucking series of digressions. So yeah, don't worry.
No, first I have to say that for one, I could never. I struggled so much with promos early because people were writing them out for me, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't cut a promo until you gave me bullet points. If I had bullet points and I could just do that and make it conversational, then I was okay. But when people were, because I still struggle to remember stuff like word for word. And when people were writing that stuff out for me, I was always so stressed about it, just remembering all that stuff, that it was just horrible. And I struggled. It was later when they really kind of just let me do my thing. And I'd go to Vince and I'd say, you know, Vince or Michael Hayes or whoever, and what point do you want me to get across? And they'd give me a point, and I'd say, okay, I got it. And I'd go out and I'd kind of wing it, and but I'd make the point. And that's when I really came into my own as far as promos go. But I was always, you know, I was always a very shy person, so it was always, public speaking was terrifying to me. Which people are always like really surprised to hear, but it was absolutely...
Yeah, no, I'm sitting here with my jaw open because that shyness is not what I would immediately equate with you.
It's weird, man, because that's, you know, that's like where all the sunglasses and all that stuff came from. It was me. They were my pacifiers. They were, you know, I was hiding behind them. I was trying to hide my fear, but it was a terrifying thing for me to go and speak in front of people. But, and then as far as... It's so weird, and I don't think people will ever get this or appreciate it about me. But when I was wrestling, all I wanted to do was wrestle. I didn't want to be an actor. I didn't want to do anything. I just loved entertaining people. I wanted to be there. I loved wrestling. I didn't want to sell them cheap T-shirts. I didn't want to. I could care less if they, you know, booed me or cheered me, as long as they, you know, I gave them a good match. And they were happy with the match. I just wanted them to be entertained. I didn't need the accolades. I don't think people will ever fucking get that. You know, I didn't come out with 25 fucking wristbands and a different T-shirt every fucking week that I'm trying to shove down their goddamn throats. People will never appreciate that. It's just because I really love the business. I love storytelling, and I love, you know, giving the fans, you know, making them feel like, you know, this is, I'm getting my money's worth. This is what I paid to see. This is good shit. I mean, I was happy with that. I was more than content with that. But I really, you know, I really wanted to pursue. It's so funny. I do a lot of things because I get pissed off. And I really hate when people tell me that I can't do stuff. And I had done, when WWE started doing films and commercials, and I noticed that everything more and more was going to Cena. But at the same time, you know, he's main eventing one series of shows. I'm main eventing the others. But he's getting all these opportunities that I'm not getting. Well, that just seemed a little unfair to me. I'm still out there, you know, busting my ass on these shows while he's making movies, getting paid a buttload of money to make these movies. And so I simply asked the question, was, you know, is there any opportunity for me to do films? And there wasn't. They had no interest in me doing that. And I said, well, you know, if I'm not afforded the opportunity here, then I should be afforded the opportunity to go outside the company and audition. And the answer was, you're our property.
Yeah,
get your ass on the house shows and get to work. And I just thought it was unfair. So I thought, you know, it's just really unfair. It's unfair to me career-wise, and it's unfair to me financially. We're, you know, basically kind of mirror images of each other on the show, or, you know, on our respective shows. But I'm getting afforded a lot less opportunities. And I just, that didn't sit well with me. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't okay with that. I wasn't content with that. And so when they said, no, I wasn't going to be afforded those opportunities, I said, well, I'm going to leave then. And, that was kind of it. And I gave them like almost a year's notice. And I gave them, you know, I did whatever they asked me to do. And I busted my ass. And they up until the day that I left, they still didn't think I was leaving. And on the night that I left, I literally, without, you know, I think a few people said goodbye to me and said thank you. But it was like a very few. And then I walked out, you know, security, Muriel, big, Sassy, escorted me out the door by myself, you know. No, you know, see you later, Dave, thanks for everything, we'll, you know, keep in touch. It was sad, man. It was really, put things in perspective on where I stood with them. And I left there with a broken back. You know, I don't think a lot of people realize that or appreciate that. But, you know, on my last match with Cena, I broke my back. And I walked out.
Shit, I had no idea. No, I didn't know that because that was, like, I thought that series with Cena was such a phenomenal, like, I thought it was great. Like, even up to and including the wheel out in the wheelchair at the end.
And that's part one of my interview with Dave Bautista. We'll be back for a big part two tomorrow as Dave and I talk WWE going with John Cena as their top star instead of Dave. This is something that we were dealing with on the ground when I was at the company in 2005. Vince's faith or lack thereof in Dave's promo skills, the creative process with Dave at WWE, and more importantly, working with James Gunn on Guardians 2 and sort of the study and contrast of how performers deal with management in different ways. So don't miss out on a great and really honest conversation with Big Dave. Go VIP, listen to it by heading over to mlwradio.com. Click on the red button at the top right corner and get in on a hell of a round two with the animal and the animalistic green guy. Thanks a lot for listening, guys.